I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. Our guest this week is UC Berkeley public health historian Elena Conis. She's the author of Vaccine Nation. We discuss the development of the polio vaccine in the 1950s and its lessons for a potential COVID-19 vaccine.
An historic victory over a dread disease is dramatically unfolded at the University of Michigan. Here, scientists usher in a new medical age with the monumental reports that prove the Salk vaccine against crippling polio to be a sensational success. It's a day of triumph for 40-year-old Dr. Jonas E. Salk, developer of the vaccine. He arrives with Basil O'Connor, head of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which financed the tests. Hundreds of reporters and scientists from all over the nation gather for the momentous announcement. Proudly on hand, too, are Mrs. Salk and the son, who received the first injections. Chief evaluator Dr. Thomas Francis pronounces the vaccine tests up to 90% effective, and modest Dr. Salk answers newsmen's questions.
This gigantic experiment is symbolic of the equally great foundations, both scientific and philanthropic, without which it could not have been conceived nor executed.
And the entire world heralded the discovery which assured an end to one of mankind's most dread diseases.
That's an April 1955 very triumphant announcement of a successful polio vaccine. Dr. Elena Conis, UC Berkeley public health and medical historian, you suggest that there are some cautionary notes when you look at the history of the polio vaccine that are relevant to today. What's the big picture? What are the largest concerns?
Sure. It's a really good question. I think that the history of polio has a lot of lessons. The history of a number of pandemic diseases have a lot of lessons for us to keep in mind today. But increasingly over the last few months, I've heard people refer to the development of the polio vaccine as an indication of our ability to come up with effective vaccines against current epidemic diseases. And it's true that in 1955, we were incredibly relieved to have the first effective polio vaccine developed using a fairly new technique, one that made a vaccine by using chemicals to inactivate, essentially kill the virus so that it was still familiar to the body. The body could elicit an immune response, but not be sickened by the virus or the viral material in the vaccine. And it's important both that we were so desperate for a vaccine at the time. It's important that people across the country felt personally invested in the vaccine's development. And I'll say more about that in a minute. And it's important, too, that this was a fairly new method that Jonas Salk's vaccine used. What happened was that once the vaccine was developed and it was approved for market use within just a few hours after the test results came out, the nation had to scramble to ensure that everybody who needed the vaccine most would get access to that vaccine. And there had been planning in the works for at least a year before the vaccine was approved for market. And that planning involved a national foundation setting aside millions to ensure that there would be a lot of vaccine purchased for young children who were most at risk of polio. That planning included getting manufacturers on board and ready to begin producing the vaccine once it was approved for market use. And yet we still had distribution problems. We still had manufacturing problems, and we still had public relations problems. People who were terrified that the vaccine was going to go to shareholders of certain companies. And in fact, some of these companies actually did send letters to their shareholders saying, you'll get the vaccine first, don't worry. People were afraid that doctors were going to charge exorbitant fees or that certain people would stockpile the vaccine. Many of these fears were realized. And in fact, the federal government had to step in and assume a bigger role in ensuring that the vaccine was distributed equitably and also that it was manufactured in a way that didn't introduce safety problems. and we might come to this in a moment, but they were forced into that position after some safety problems did emerge.
So we get to spend almost an hour with you to learn more about the polio pandemic and where the comparisons help us understand and where the world has really changed. But let me start with asking you really what is, because it's still very much a live disease in parts of the world. What is polio?
Sure. Here in the U.S., it's something that children get routinely vaccinated against, and we don't tend to think of it terribly much. It's a viral infection. We've known that since the early 1900s. It's something that people generally acquire from drinking or eating food that has been contaminated with fecal matter that contains the virus. The virus passes through the gastrointestinal system of humans. And when you are infected with the virus, if it causes disease, in young children, sometimes that disease is inapparent, that infection is inapparent. But in slightly older children, and also in teens and sometimes adults, that virus can trigger a debilitating disease that can paralyze. It attacks the nervous system, and it can leave people, in some of the worst cases, essentially paralyzed from the neck down. Sometimes this paralysis is fleeting, temporary, and sometimes it's permanent. And in the early part of the 20th century, what we had was a number of small outbreaks of polio in the early 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, and then it ramped up and we had more and more outbreaks of the disease. And these were terrifying outbreaks for people. Nobody wants to see a young child struck with paralysis. It was one of the most frightening things that people could imagine.
In fact, one of the quotes I found in reading about it was, by the middle of the 20th century, polio was described as, quote, one of the most frightening public health problems in the world. Was it the paralysis that was so frightening for people?
It was the paralysis. It was the unpredictability of it. A town could go several years without a case of polio and then all of a sudden have an outbreak that left huge numbers of children and adults affected. And there was a famous photo spread in Life magazine in 1944 where they sent photographers down to the town of Hickory, North Carolina, a relatively small and sort of somewhat rural town that suddenly felt like a war zone. There were so many children and adults struck that it quickly exceeded their medical capacity and their capacity to provide care for the patients who, in the worst cases, needed to be housed in something called an iron lung, an enormous contraption that fit from the neck down that essentially breathed for the patient, allowed air to enter and then exit their lungs, their paralyzed respiratory systems, and took the place of their paralyzed respiratory systems. So Hickory, North Carolina provided a really vivid snapshot to towns that hadn't experienced a polio epidemic yet. It showed army tents hastily constructed, turned into these makeshift hospitals all around any green space available in the town, army vehicles shuttling in supplies. It showed doctors and nurses having to call on neighboring communities to bring in whoever they could to help treat these patients and help those who were most likely to survive, at least survive the worst bout of the disease, and then figure out how to rehabilitate them. As I mentioned, in some cases, the paralysis was fleeting. In some cases, however, certain limbs would remain paralyzed for decades, if not for life.
Well, the scenes of the tents and the assistance from the military and the like will be very familiar to people who have been watching the last 3 months unfold.
Absolutely. It's exactly like that. And people saw, you know, a quiet, otherwise humdrum community suddenly torn to shreds. And people in those communities were afraid to leave their homes. And in fact, in some cases, didn't need town or citywide shelter-in-place ordinances because once the epidemic became clear, people stayed at home. They kept their kids close. Health departments would put up flyers and put out notices saying, you know, stay inside, avoid gatherings, avoid quote-unquote new people or people you don't know. And these places just entirely shut down. And at the same time, if they had a large number of patients, all that remained visible was something that really looked like a war zone.
We have a headline from a San Antonio newspaper that will also look familiar to people today. All San Antonio schools close as two more polio suspect cases reported. So people were actively social distancing while the real cause of polio was unknown at that point.
Yeah, throughout the early decades of the 20th century, there was a lot of uncertainty. People knew that there was a virus involved with polio's transmission and manifestation, but what people didn't know was how that virus was transmitted from one person to another. And there were a number of theories. People thought that it was transmitted through contaminated food. People thought that it might have been transmitted by flies that were picking up the virus and taking it from one place to another. A lot of blame, especially in the middle decades of the first half of the 20th century, fell on immigrant communities, and people felt that immigrants were bringing the disease into the U.S. And this led to a variety of efforts to control the disease. Social distancing, yes, although people didn't call it that at the time. And in some communities, they responded with a kind of across-the-board social distancing or stay in place, shelter in place. In other cases, they really focused on children because it was children, again, of that early school age, 5 to 9, who were thought to be most vulnerable and to suffer the worst effects of the disease. So some communities banned gatherings, fairs, closed festivals and camps and schools and things like that, just to keep children at the very least at home and away from clusters of other people.
While this was happening globally in the United States, the most famous case had to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who contracted the disease in 1921. He was 39, which seems outside the parameters of what you described. How did this person who then went into public life and ultimately to the White House, how did his contraction of polio impact the public understanding or amount of attention they paid to polio?
Yeah, Roosevelt's polio is really interesting. In recent decades, a number of people have looked back and questioned whether he actually did have polio. But in effect, for understanding history, it doesn't really matter if he did or not, because at the time, that was his understanding and it was the nation's understanding. And he contracted it, the story goes, after a day in the country with his family. He was swimming, playing outside, had a really long active day, came home and was just leveled. And the next day woke up and had some of the telltale signs, and gradually paralysis set in. In Roosevelt's case, he was older than the kind of poster child for polio. He was an adult. He did recover. He didn't die, completely succumb to polio, but he did have lasting paralysis, which he took great pains to hide as he pursued his political career. And he had agreements with the press corps wherever he went that they would only photograph him in ways that his wheelchair and his leg braces would not be seen. The story of his polio was one of triumph. A man who was struck down in the prime of his life overcame the disease and then went on to an absolutely unprecedented in many ways political career. So Roosevelt's polio became a story of inspiration for many other polio patients. And the other thing that Roosevelt did was he started a small foundation, and he started it and then handed it over to his law partner, Basil O'Connor. And Basil O'Connor, as Roosevelt pursued more and more political opportunities, Basil O'Connor grew this foundation larger and larger until it became an enormous philanthropy, the biggest one at the time that really the country and possibly the world had ever seen. Initially, it was called the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and that's because polio was known as infantile paralysis. Later, they called it the March of Dimes, which might be a more familiar name to some viewers. And they were incredibly creative in bringing attention to the disease and in using Roosevelt and his triumph over polio as a means to mobilize the public to contribute to and to donate funds and time to try to find a cure and to find treatment.
I'm sure some people listening to this who are in last years of middle age will remember March of Dimes solicitations among school children and movie theaters. So it was really very much a grassroots effort at the time, wasn't it?
It really was. And in its earliest iteration, while it was still the National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis, O'Connor started with this idea that when Roosevelt became president, he was such a beloved president that O'Connor thought, let's have an annual birthday ball. And people will hold these birthday balls on the president's birthday in their communities, whatever size their community is, and use those birthday balls as a fundraiser for infantile paralysis or polio. And these birthday balls really took off. People signed up in communities all across the country, held their own birthday parties for Roosevelt, has served food, danced, brought people together, and raised money and donated it to this national philanthropy. What O'Connor did that was incredibly brilliant for the time, he started these birthday balls in the 30s for a country coming out of a depression. This was an incredible feat. And O'Connor was really savvy in thinking about how he could make everybody feel like they could contribute. And he sought Hollywood celebrities, musicians, stars of all kinds, everybody from Marilyn Monroe to Louis Armstrong, to record radio and TV spots, to appear in posters. And in time, came up with such an enormous cadre of Hollywood supporters that it was hard for anybody to not have heard of the March of Dimes. There's an interesting story about how the March of Dimes got its name, or how the name came about, which probably some of your viewers have heard. One of the celebrities that O'Connor recruited to the cause was a comedian, Eddie Cantor, who was doing a radio appearance, and he was encouraging people to donate to the cause of infantile paralysis. And he, again, following O'Connor's vision, was trying to convince people, just give whatever you can. And he said, how about dimes? If everybody just puts a dime in an envelope, we'll have a march of dimes all the way to the White House. And he used this phrase, march of dimes, and apparently the radio spot was so successful that the White House mailroom was just flooded with envelopes of dimes, and the idea and the phrase March of Dimes stuck.
And again, here are parallels to all of this, the social media that we're seeing with Hollywood celebrities and people, YouTube celebrities and like, all soliciting the public support for the social distancing, use of masks and that sort of thing. So the celebrity role in addressing these epidemics and pandemics seems to be something that's been around for a while.
It's been around for a while. I don't think anybody had done it to the extent that the March of Dimes had done it. And they never really let go of it. The March of Dimes still exists, of course, but their heyday in the 40s and 50s was a moment in which they were, you know, first using radio heavily and then were very savvy about using TV too, especially as TV started to become more common in American households. And so as the research on polio developed, as their funds shuttled, in some cases, hundreds of iron lungs across the country and into hard-hit communities, they would show footage, and then they would have a little spot with the celebrity, say Elvis Presley, for instance, you know, doing his part to show how important the cause was. So it has been around for a long time.
So by the mid-1940s, without really understanding the source of the polio virus, that people were beginning to use techniques that to our 2020 ears and eyes look really shocking. We have a universal newsreel from 1946, and we'll come back and talk about this method used to combat polio.
With the possibility of a grave infantile paralysis epidemic, San Antonio health authorities attacked germ carriers on a citywide front. With war-discovered DDT in special sprayers, sections of the city are literally fogged with the insecticide in the fight to stop the spread of polio. Every suspected spot is sprayed. The drastic cleanup is ordered as polio and allied diseases show alarming increase. Even streams come in for disinfecting. And in the parks, precautions are taken to prevent gatherings of youngsters. Literally tons of DDT are used on this dread disease that attacks our young. Again, war, destructive and terrible, contributes one of its discoveries to save life.
war contributes one of its discoveries to save life. You've done a lot of work on DDT. How extensive was its use in the country? And now we know that it has a lot of dangers for the human body. So how soon were the side effects of its use apparent?
Yeah, those are really good questions. As the clip showed, DDT was developed during the Second World War. It was actually discovered first by a scientist at a Swiss drug company, and then the U.S. Army's scientists and medical officers then tested it throughout the world during the war, and they were absolutely just blown away by how effective DDT was at killing diseases, killing bugs like mosquitoes that carried diseases like malaria and yellow fever. And so there was this incredible enthusiasm for DDT during the war, because these were diseases that in tropical and semi-tropical settings had proved absolutely debilitating to troops in previous wars. And now we had a way of killing the bugs that spread them and doing so in a way that actually didn't seem to cause any harm. If you think about it, at the time, some of the common pesticides and the common chemicals that we used to kill mosquitoes and other pests before the Second World War were chemicals that included arsenic and lead, and people would purchase produce at the market and it would have residue on it, and they would take it home and hopefully wash it well enough to remove that residue, because if you didn't, and this happened in a number of cases, you could end up with lead poisoning or arsenic poisoning. So DDT was an incredible discovery for the time. You could spray not only fields full of mosquitoes, but you could spray orchards and then send those crops to market. And what happened was, after the war, there were so many manufacturers that had been producing DDT during the war that were really eager to sell it to the American consumer after the war. There was also this widespread knowledge. Everybody had watched the newsreels of planes spraying DDT over islands in the Pacific and protecting U.S. and allied troops from malaria. So people were familiar with the idea that DDT killed problematic insects. After the war, we were left still with polio epidemics here in the U.S., and people were struggling with these competing theories of how it spread and struggling to find ways to prevent its spread. And I mentioned a little earlier that one of the theories about polio was that it was possibly spread by flies. So very, very quickly, people put two and two together and thought, why don't we go ahead and kill all the flies with DDT? Now that DDT is available for Americans to buy, let's just spray as widely as we can and try to keep polio at bay. And in fact, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, still not yet called the March of Dimes, had an agreement with the Army that as soon as the Army no longer needed the DDT that it was consuming, they would free up surplus supplies and free up some of these vehicles that had been equipped to emit DDT fogs. And the National Foundation would coordinate with a town that had a couple of cases of polio and seemed like it might be on the brink of an epidemic. And it would send in these army tanks, and it would send in army bombers that were equipped with big spray tanks strapped to their undersides, underbellies. And they would coat the town with DDT and try to see if that kept a polio epidemic at bay. What was probably most fascinating about this is that the initial results were hard to interpret. They sprayed one town, which they actually divided in half, and it seemed like there was less polio on one side of the town than there was on the unsprayed side of the town. Then they sprayed an entire town that had just the first hints of a polio epidemic, and the epidemic never materialized. And a lot of people were really eager to believe that we had a cure, that we had a way of preventing polio. And so very, very quickly, counties and cities across the U.S. got incredibly excited and started buying large quantities of DDT to either prepare for a polio outbreak or if they had a couple of cases. And even though at this time, the National Foundation and many of the scientists that it supported were desperately asking the public to stop and wait until more scientific testing was done, the public couldn't wait. And towns all over the place, from San Antonio to places in Idaho, Illinois, you name it, they would just spray from top to bottom. And because the understanding was that DDT was not toxic, people thought, leave your kids outside, let them play in the spray of the DDT trucks. It smelled kind of sweet. It didn't leave a sticky residue. And people thought it was a very safe place to be after the war. It was incredibly just remarkable how a cloud of DDT suddenly became a very safe place to be.
Did it create its own health problems?
It did, in time. And in fact, while DDT was being tested during the war, a number of the scientists who were testing it here in the U.S., in Georgia and Florida in particular, and also Washington State, were pointing out that if they use too much DDT or too high a concentration of DDT in the environment in particular, they were noticing die-offs of not just problematic insects, but beneficial insects like bees, which we need to pollinate. They were noticing sometimes that fish and frogs were dying too. And what they said was, we really need to watch out because this is a poison. It is a toxic chemical, and we don't know what the full effects might be. Some scientists also, testing it before it was widely used, showed that when dogs, for instance, or goats were fed food that had DDT in it or residue on it, they accumulated that DDT in the fat of their bodies. And in the female animals, it accumulated in their breast milk. And in one experiment, they made butter from milk from goats that had eaten DDT. And the butter had so much DDT in it that the butter killed flies. And these were some of the first hints that DDT was not entirely safe. It was very quickly apparent that it was a horrible toxin and toxic material and terribly damaging to a number of species in the environment, and that it also built up inside of the human body. It took us decades. In fact, we're still trying to understand the full health effects of DDT. It took decades to try to make clear that DDT exposure, especially at certain times of life, could cause certain forms of cancer later on. But it turns out DDT was in fact a weak carcinogen or a weak cause of cancer. So there's still some debate about this science, and there is still scientific investigation into other health effects of DDT, things from Alzheimer's to Parkinson's disease, that's still ongoing, and diabetes as well.
So as the 1940s rolled into the 1950s, the number of polio outbreaks continued to rise. It looks like 1952 was really a watershed year. The statistics that are often reported from that year, 57,000 plus cases, 3,100 plus deaths. And this is the shocking number: of the 57,000, 21,269 cases of paralysis. So as that was happening, walk us through the development of vaccines. Where was that taking place around the country? And was it simply foundations who were supporting it, or was the government involved?
Sure, that's a really good question. So 1952 was a horrible year. And as you pointed out, those numbers, they gripped the nation with fear, and they're far lower than the coronavirus numbers that we're seeing today. So that might be another important lesson for us. But what happened was, the foundation knew that it had to invest not just in treatment for polio patients, but also in either a cure or a means of prevention. And by the early 1950s, it was supporting a number of teams of scientists who were working on different types of vaccines. And eventually there were a couple of scientists who kind of pulled ahead of the pack. One group was working on a vaccine that used chemical treatment to inactivate, essentially kill the vaccine, so that this killed virus could be put into a vaccine. And another group was developing a kind of more classic type of vaccine, in which they effectively created a weakened version of the virus, and it was still polio virus, but it was supposed to not cause polio. There were a number of scientists working in both camps, and some of the research that they conducted, a lot of this was supported by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, but a number of these scientists had been heavily funded during the Second World War by the federal government, which had funded them to try to come up with vaccines during the war to protect troops, not from polio, but from things like the flu and measles and mumps, for instance. So there were a number of advances in vaccine science made during the war that some of these teams drew on as they were working hard to find a polio vaccine. There was one team at Harvard, I believe, which during the war was funded entirely by the government and was working around the clock 24/7 to try to develop a measles vaccine. And they developed some helpful techniques to culture the virus in the lab. But then as soon as the war ended, they shifted entirely. And by then they were being funded wholly by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, not to develop a measles vaccine, but to develop a polio vaccine. And the reason why I point this out is because, in effect, there was this sort of back and forth going on at the time. In war, we had a different set of priorities, and scientific attention was focused on those. After the war, our scientific priorities shifted again. Once we came up with a polio vaccine, then the technology that was developed to produce that polio vaccine was then used as the basis and inspiration for a number of vaccines that followed. And so we ended up with a bunch of new vaccines in the 1960s. So there was this sort of back and forth of scientific attention being focused on different diseases, depending on what the national priority was at the time. And as we already know from the early clip at the top of the hour, the vaccine, the polio vaccine that made it across the finish line first, was the one developed by Jonas Salk. And Salk was determined, absolutely determined, that he had the vision for what was going to be an effective vaccine. And with the foundation's help, one of the biggest vaccine trials was conducted with something like 1.2 million American children. And I think there were another 400,000 who were also tested in Canada and Finland. This was an unprecedented number of people participating in a trial of a new vaccine. And when the vaccine was fully tested in that enormous study population, it was shown to protect against what were then known to be three different types of poliovirus. It was very effective against two of those viral types, and mostly effective against the third viral type. But such details didn't really matter to a country that was so desperate for anything, to let them go back to normal.
So I have another historic video from the year 1954 as that massive testing was taking place. And this brings together a lot of threads because people will instantly recognize the use of celebrities to enjoin people to the cause. Let's watch.
You know, every child has a right to that, health and happiness.
That's right. But there are an awful lot of children that don't even have that.
Yes, Dessie. And there are a lot of parents whose children are healthy and happy now who live in fear. I know I do. The fear, my friends, is polio, infantile paralysis.
Polio is no respecter of people. The rich, the poor, the strong, the weak, no one is immune.
But soon, perhaps within a year, there may be a vaccine available to all that may be the answer.
That's right. There is a trial vaccine now being tested. It has been tested successfully on 700 people. But now the vital large-scale tests must be conducted. Hundreds of thousands of people will be inoculated starting next month.
Vaccines and tests cost a great deal of money. Now here is your chance to help get this test done as quickly as possible. Give every dime and dollar that you can spare to the 1954 March of Dimes.
So as they talked about, that's Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, of course, and they talked about the enormous effort, those numbers over globally, 1.8 million school children, 20,000 physicians were involved in testing in the United States, and 64,000 school officials. You've done so much work on vaccines. Was there not public resistance to being inoculated with a substance that was still being tested?
Absolutely. So there was resistance. That resistance did not get any media attention, pretty close to none at the time. So it's hard to find traces of it, but it was there. There was also incredible acceptance. And it strikes me as not too unlike the cases we see today of people very eager to sign up as participants in early tests of the current coronavirus vaccines that are in development. Back then, people were actually very, very excited to sign up their children for these trials. And in some cases, people were disappointed if they weren't able to sign their children up. At least that was the story as it was recorded. But there was resistance. In fact, there were people who had been resistant to vaccines for decades, going back to the 19th century, and among them were people who had their own philosophies of healing. There were people who didn't believe in drugs generally or had concerns about modern technologies. There were some critics who put the polio vaccine in the same category as such things as Coca-Cola and cigarettes and pesticides. There were also people who had religious arguments against taking the vaccine. And none of these people were mounting new arguments that were only relevant because there was a polio vaccine. These ideas, these sources of resistance to any vaccine and vaccination generally were age old. And we'd been seeing them in this country for decades, if not close to a century by then. And in fact, we've been seeing them globally since the first vaccine was developed against smallpox in the 1790s. So what's striking about the 1950s testing and then rollout of the polio vaccine to me is how little attention the media gave to criticism and voices of skepticism compared to how much we give to it now. But also how much kind of excitement and enthusiasm there was for the vaccine, even as it was in its early stages, and even as this meant not testing it necessarily just in adults, but in children too.
So we saw the big announcement in April of 1955, and then we have to move into the story of what happened when it went into manufacturing and distribution. Before we do, a couple of quick questions just for comparison today. The CDC was founded in 1946. Was it playing a role in all of this, as we're seeing it play today with the coronavirus?
A very, very different role. A very, very, compared to today, passive role. The CDC really stepped up its involvement after the vaccine was developed, and in fact stepped up its involvement even more after the first batch of bad vaccine was identified. And I'll go ahead and tell the story briefly. The need to develop as much vaccine as possible meant that a number of drug manufacturers were recruited to help produce the soft polio vaccine as soon as it was licensed for use. Some of them had never made a drug like this before. And one of these drug companies was Cutter Laboratories here in Berkeley, California, where I am. This was a family-owned, decades-old drug company with a really good reputation. And workers were, they believed, following the protocol as it had been given to them. But this was just weeks into the national vaccination effort. A number of cases of polio were occurring in people who were vaccinated. And in a handful, close to a dozen of those cases were deadly. And this was ultimately traced back to Cutter Labs' vaccine and the fact that in their facility, they had not properly inactivated or killed all of the virus that was included. So some live polio virus was making its way into this particular batch of vaccine. So this was so absolutely terrifying that the Surgeon General asked for a complete halt until they could figure out what was going on, and then gradually brought the manufacturers back online one at a time, ensuring that they were up to date with all of their safety protocols. In the meantime, epidemiologists from the CDC were invited to help figure out and trace the cause of these cases of polio. They were the ones who helped trace it back to Qatar Labs, and they were also invited to help come up with a protocol for moving forward. The CDC, as you mentioned, had been created during the Second World War. Its initial name was actually, it had malaria in the title, Malaria Control in War Areas, MCWA was the name of the agency. And after the war, with the war over and malaria effectively gone from the U.S., the CDC's epidemiologists and scientists were really looking for the next way that they could provide value to the U.S. Polio outbreaks were one way, although absent any treatment or cure, CDC epidemiologists were hard-pressed to help. And once the vaccine was available, they suddenly had a new role to play. And after this incident, which was called the Qatar incident for Qatar Labs, the CDC scientists became more and more visible as a voice of authority and expertise on polio vaccination and then subsequently vaccination generally.
We have a video from 1991 of Jonas Salk. He became, of course, a global celebrity, as I understand it, much to his chagrin. Here he is talking in 1991 about the development and some of those manufacturing problems, just so people can see and what he looked and sounded like.
And within a matter of about 10 days or 2 weeks, after it went into production, I mean, it was into use, there was a report of cases of polio caused by the vaccine. Now, there was no such encounter in the field trial, and it was encountered only as a result of the use of the vaccine from one particular laboratory. The vaccine was suspended. Its use was suspended for a short period of time, reintroduced again after that problem was isolated and that vaccine was withdrawn. All the others were used, and things then proceeded in a normal fashion. That's just an example of some of the hazards that one has to deal with, particularly at that level of experimentation.
So a couple quick questions about that. First, is it true that he did not ever seek a patent on his polio vaccine?
Yeah, that is true. And he publicly said that he didn't believe that a patent was the morally responsible thing to do. He believed that the vaccine belonged to the people, and he saw the vaccine as kind of crucial to health and well-being. He did not, as far as I know, seek a patent. It's also worth kind of wrapping back. He was in intense competition with especially Albert Sabin, who in Cincinnati was leading another team of scientists who were developing a different type of vaccine, one that used a live weakened version of the polio virus. And Salk was devastated by the Qatar incident, relieved to say the least when it was resolved. But there was this constant tension once Albert Sabin's vaccine came to market, this constant tension between the two over which was the better product and which should be the prevailing polio vaccine for the country. They each had different advantages and disadvantages. And in fact, to this day, we still use both of them globally. Although in the global polio eradication, which is seeking to eliminate polio in the last few remaining countries where it's present, we tend to use Sabin's vaccine, which is administered orally and requires far less boosters. In other words, no shot and far fewer doses.
The last recorded case of polio in the United States after that 1955 introduction was 1979. What took so long for it to be eradicated in the United States?
That's an interesting question. A historian would phrase it very differently and would say, wow, that was fast. If you think about it, the first smallpox vaccine was developed in the late 1790s. And I think the last smallpox case in the US, I think, was 1948. So for polio, that timeline seems quite compressed relative to smallpox. What happened with polio, to give you kind of a big picture view of what transpired after the first vaccine was approved, there was so much involvement and so much activity in the first few years after SOX vaccine was approved that vaccination rates and coverage they skyrocketed. Millions and millions of people got vaccinated in those first couple of years, and polio cases plummeted between 1955 and 1957. Then what happened after 1957 was you started to see this kind of gradual departure between those who had the means. They could afford the time and the money to take their kids to the doctor on an annual basis, for instance. They, you know, stayed up to date on the news and followed expert advice. These people continued to get their kids vaccinated, while other people, either who didn't have the means or weren't aware of the need, were getting their kids vaccinated at a far lower rate. And so in 1958 and 1959, you start to see polio cases creeping back up just a little bit, but starting to creep back up. And then we start seeing outbreaks, and these are predominantly happening in poor communities, in urban areas where poor communities are living in crowded conditions and are out of reach of access to healthcare and don't have routine visits to doctors, for instance. And in those areas, CDC epidemiologists and others start to realize that people just aren't getting vaccinated at the same rate. So we had this sort of push and pull throughout the late 50s into the 60s. And by the 70s, polio vaccination was really widespread among children. And by that time, we had enough immune adults that it became most important to focus on children. And we were capturing them at that point largely through laws that required vaccination for school. In the 1970s, however, it gradually became clear that the remaining cases of polio in the country were those caused by the live virus vaccine, which sometimes led to community transmission of polio virus as the virus was shed, say, for example, in the fecal matter of children. So we then started to move away from that vaccine and switch back to the Salk vaccine, and effectively finally got to a place where we had no more polio in this country.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and I want to spend that last 10 minutes talking about the lessons for today. Let's begin with President Trump just a few days ago talking about the development of vaccines.
Tremendous progress is being made on vaccines. In fact, we have ready to go in terms of transportation and logistics. We have over 2 million ready to go if it checks out for safety.
So you co-authored a piece in the New York Times, which gave us the idea for talking to you further about this, about the cautionary notes. So what are the kinds of challenges that the American public should be aware of about the development, safe development, and distribution of a coronavirus vaccine?
Sure. Well, one of the first of them is the fact that any vaccine that's tested is tested in a large group of people, but not nearly as large a group of people as it will ultimately be used in. So in this country, we try to monitor as best we can vaccines as they're used so that we can keep tabs on any unwanted side effects that only show up, say, when 1 million or 2 million people have received the vaccine. So that's one thing that I think we need to keep in mind. I think the other one is we have, I think it's well over 100 different vaccines in development right now, all using different approaches to vaccine development. And this means that there may be a top vaccine candidate that uses a technology that we haven't used or haven't used extensively before. And we may be calling, as we did in the days of polio, on manufacturers who haven't actually manufactured a product like this before. So we don't, in such a case, we again won't know if there have been manufacturing problems until the vaccines are widely used. I don't mean to sound exceptionally cynical or skeptical here. We have spent, in fact, using polio as our starting point, decades refining and adding on to the safety and regulatory procedures in place for ensuring that drugs that get to market are not just safe, but also effective at the same time, and that effectiveness does not compromise safety and vice versa. And what we've heard in the last couple of months is some of our leaders telling us that a number of regulatory protocols are now being set aside, and that they're being set aside in the interest of bringing effective drugs to market quickly. I hope this doesn't have negative consequences. One can never say. I just know that we spent decades putting these regulatory processes in place for a reason. And I hope that, one, we put them back in place when and if we can put this pandemic behind us. And two, that the ways in which we're trying to make vaccine development more efficient now don't come at any steep costs. We will already be dealing with steep costs because we will face distribution problems. We will face problems of equity. Even if we have enough vaccine for everybody, there will be those who have the privilege to say, I'm not comfortable getting it until, 5 million people have been vaccinated. And then there will be those who say, I have to get vaccinated because I have to go to work and I have to make sure that I am safe and that I can provide for my family. So I guarantee that we will see problems of equity. Historians aren't supposed to guarantee anything about the future, but this is one thing I feel concerned about.
What didn't exist in the 1950s is genomic science. So how does the cracking of the gene help with the development of vaccines today?
Well, in a couple of ways. And I'm not a scientist, so I'll just say a few brief things. But from my understanding of it is once you can see the genetics of a virus like this, scientists can design a vaccine very quickly. That means they can essentially, like an architect, come up with the blueprint for it. That doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be quick to build it or to test it, but you can design it very quickly, and you can design it in a very refined, specific way. It also means that you can produce vaccines that look potentially very different from the polio vaccines that we've been talking about. They don't contain a whole virus in either killed or weakened form. They just contain genetic material from the virus, or that resembles the virus's genetic material. And that's familiar enough that the immune system in the human body recognizes it and mounts an immune response. So yeah, I'll highlight those two differences.
Last month, there was a headline in the Washington Post that read that coronavirus may never go away, even with a vaccine. So are we, as a global society, looking at eradication of COVID-19 or containment?
I think that we probably need to focus on both. But one thing that I am struck by, again, as a historian, not a scientist, is that I am now living through a pandemic that has caused the kind of social disorder that I have read about in history books and have never lived through in my own lifetime. Polio is a close example, but that happened before I was born. But if you look at the history of infectious disease, you see diseases such as, smallpox is one, plague is another, yellow fever, cholera. Smallpox is the only one on that list that I mentioned that has been eradicated. Polio is close to eradication. Plague is still with us. And people think, oh, plague, we haven't had that since, the Black Death or the Middle Ages. But it's still a presence. We just contain it and we manage it. And that is a possibility for coronavirus. We may never develop a vaccine against it. And it may be with us for centuries. It may be with us for millennia. And if it is, it will mean that we have found ways of not just containing it, but adapting to it as well.
So in our few minutes left, I want to tell people that you wrote a book about vaccines called Vaccine Nation and published in 2015, still widely available if people are interested in it. And what is your current book project that you're working on?
Right now, I'm actually working on a book about the pesticide DDT and how essentially our interpretation of scientific results changes over time, not just because science changes, but because culture, politics, economics changes. And that all prompts us to look at the science and understand it differently. It'll be a very different look at the pesticide DDT and its very contentious history.
So as you mentioned, as we close here, that you're living through history as a public health and medical historian, what are you and your colleagues looking at as we go through the coronavirus experience? And what kind of data are you gathering that will help record this for history and help a public's future understanding of it?
You know, a lot of fellow historians are looking at current media coverage and social media discourse and also government reports and studies and trying to amass digital archives of the current pandemic. I think others are also thinking about what those of us who are historians of medicine know well, which has been proven with striking clarity with the current pandemic, which is that a pandemic grossly exposes the inequities in a society. And if there are problems before the pandemic will worsen them. And we have seen that with this one. And it is such a striking illustration of something that history has shown us over and over again, whether it was polio, whether it was smallpox, whether it was cholera in the 19th century. All of these diseases show us the difference between those who have privilege and those who don't. And we are definitely seeing that this time, too.
When are you expecting to welcome students back into the classroom again?
Oh, I shouldn't speak for my university. I've been told that we will welcome small groups of students back into our classrooms and much larger groups online. And I'm still meeting with students through the summer too, a small selection of students through the summer who are working on some of this work with me.
Well, thank you very much for giving C-SPAN an hour. Dr. Elena Conis is a public health and medical historian at UC Berkeley. In a previous life, she was a journalist and a columnist, and we're glad to have all of that experience melded into your conversation with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email at podcasts@c-span.org with your questions, comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.